welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are at minute 103, so don't turn around. The Herr Capitan is in town. Hal, why don't you fill us in on what's going on way up in the skies over, I guess, the Arctic? Wherever they're at.
Somewhere they are. Now I'm stuck on Der Kommissar. Was that
Falco? You're a super freak.
Okay. Well, right back at you, pal. All right. Minute 103. Steve Rogers pilots the New York flying bomb, weaving through a barrage of blue energy bolts to the aft of the Valkyrie. He aims for the tail section, crashing the craft into the fuselage, embedding it among the girders in a cascade of sparks. Opening the canopy, Steve leaps out, retrieving his vibranium shield from beneath the catwalk. He navigates through the cavernous cockpit of the flying wing, searching for the Red Skull. The space is eerily quiet, lit by the low hum and blue glow of the Tesseract reactor. Approaching the high-backed pilot's chair, Steve senses movement. He spins, raising his shield just in time to deflect an energy bolt from the Red Skull's futuristic rifle. "You don't give up, do you?" the Red Skull sneers. "Nope," Steve retorts, lunging forward. He blocks a flurry of energy bolts, his shield flashing. With a swift move, Steve knocks the rifle from the Red Skull's hands. He swings the shield's edge, aiming for his opponent's neck, but the Red Skull dodges, the strike grazing past.
One thing that Joe really knows how to, well, Joe knows a lot of things to do, but he really knows how to put together a fight scene. This is the one we've wanted. He didn't get enough at the bottomless chasm, but here we go hand to hand or hand to shield.
A good fight scene between worthy opponents. And, you know, you've heard me say a lot on this show that in a superhero film, I don't like it when there's an evenly matched villain too soon. You know, when you've got, Superman and General Zod just playing rock'em sock'em robots in a town. It's like, you know, I want to see Superman being super and before he meets his match. But this is very satisfying, this climax here. We've seen Captain America be super heroic enough. Now, you know, the stakes are a bit higher because he's back at it, trading blows with an equal of sorts.
And wasn't it fortunate that he crashed into the plane that had his vibranium shield stuck in it?
Well, that was one of my notes. Do you think he did that on purpose, that he said, okay, I want that spot because that's where I left my shield? And what do you think the odds are of him surviving a crash into a structure crisscrossed with steel girders?
Well, I was thinking about that piece of it. But before we dive into that, I also, I've been on assignment on and off, and I will be again for our next episode, unfortunately. But did you guys discuss at all the significance of him being in the New York bomb of all of the bombs?
No, good point, though.
I think that's a nice little touch, too, that just happened to be that way. I don't think he sat there and said, New York, Chicago. Now I'll take, I'm a kid from Brooklyn. But it's just a nice little bit of things, him saving the city. But, you know, the interesting thing about his crash and his impact is thinking about the relative velocity. So number one, presumably these things being piloted bombs, that there would be some sort of manual arming procedure that Steve would not have turned on. So we shouldn't be worrying too much about the bomb itself sort of going off. But, when he's coming in, if, you know, the flying wing's doing 500 miles an hour and he's doing 540 miles an hour or whatever, you know, whatever those true airspeeds worked out to be, that it's that relative velocity that at least makes it plausible. And
right. He still hits, it's not a head-on crash.
Yeah, he still comes in and hits pretty hard. But, maybe he's only doing, I'm pulling numbers out of the air, but maybe he's only doing about 40 and, you know, versus the hundreds that they're actually traveling.
Yeah, he does stop pretty abruptly, but, and I like that kind of clang, and he comes with it. But the same thing occurred to me is, relative to the flying wing, or their relative speed is, could be 20, 30, 40 miles an hour. That's just that's a pretty good size auto crash, but it's survivable. It's all right.
Sure.
But he could have been decapitated by any of them girders that he came through.
Right, exactly. is there a pun in there, Brian? Decapitated? Or
decapitated.
Is that, well, then the whole film would have been uncapped, decapitated.
Yeah. Hal, you do me a great favor by making me sound smarter than I am. That was great. Thank you.
Well, one does one's humble best to please, Brian.
Right.
I was trying to figure out, I guess the flying wing is not pressurized. If he's just wandering around with doors and stuff, and I don't know how low is he flying? It would have to be under what, 16,000 feet, 14,000 feet for.
So, I mean, depending on, if you want to talk about legalities and things, you start for extended periods above 10,000 feet, you start needing oxygen for the flight crew. Above 12,500, legally, you need it for everybody, but the Red Skull is super, and so who knows what sort of abilities he has. Mountaineers certainly summit much higher peaks than that without oxygen. But it's a great point, because we would have expected them to be operating at higher altitudes, and certainly, allied bomber crews in particular doing higher altitude bombings with bigger formations. They were on oxygen. They had their own oxygen bottles and things. So that's a great point, because it certainly looks to me like he's high enough. And certainly to go that distance, you wouldn't want to go 1 foot lower than you had to, because the higher you go, the more efficient you're going to be fuel wise.
Yeah, I noticed the one scene around the middle of the minute, like around second 30 or 31, we're looking out the window and it looks like they're suborbital. It's just the sky is black.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's. Yeah. It's just, I don't think the propellers are going to be working anymore.
It's interesting that the Hydra goons too are wearing those full face masks, and it'd be very possible for them to have some kind of oxygen thing built into those face masks, because even if the flying wings pressurized, I don't know that those individual bombs would be. You'd think that the pilots would want to have some oxygen there for themselves on their suicide missions. And then it got me wondering what the Red Skull's customized oxygen mask might look like with no nose.
Yeah, would it just have like an extra, like would the mask have a nose?
Right. I guess, basically. Yeah.
You got to have a nose somewhere to make that seal.
I don't know, but he's not wearing one. And as you said, Hal, maybe it's just because he's a super soldier, but good
and
point.
Pretty cold too. I mean, he's worried about freezing under the ice, and the ice is only, zero Celsius. I'm sure it's a lot colder where he's at right now.
Colder up there.
Yeah.
And then again, we could also be, maybe there's a Tesseract field that's serving the same purpose. That's causing pressurization, but doesn't need things like bulkheads and actual structure.
In our, I believe it's our previous episode, Jim noted the Maxfield Parish cloudy skies. And I thought that was just so evocative. What a wonderful turn of phrase. But in the context of, gee, they sure are getting good at rendering clouds these days. And we see more of that in this minute. It's beautifully done. I think there's a shot where the flying wing is flying close over some clouds, and you can see the shadow of the flying wing cast down onto the clouds. And it just gives it such a nice feeling of reality, of 3D-ness, of verisimilitude. These guys are smart.
They really are. And that those Maxfield Parish clouds have always been, I mean, that's always a sky that just makes me stop and stare. And, one of the things that we get here in flatland in the Midwest that didn't necessarily get as much of living in the mountainous West Coast as I did much of my life, are those just gigantic, gigantic fronts that will come through, and you can see them for, hundreds of miles in every direction or something. And at sunsets, those can get very, very spectacular. Yeah. As a kid, I'll go ahead and date myself. I thought of those clouds as zonker clouds, as in screaming yellow zonkers.
Ah, yes. The yellow
popcorn treat.
Yes.
The cousin to fiddle faddle, which fiddle faddle seems to keep coming back, and zonkers very rarely do, once in a great while.
Yeah, it's
great.
It pops up about every decade or so. Yeah.
Yeah, they're sort of just artificially yellow popcorn. That's what the cumulus always looked like to me. And
somebody buys the brand and tries to put them out again. And
yeah, it's Zonkers and Quisp cereal. There's another one that
Quisp and Quake.
Quisp and Quake. That will occasionally.
Were you a Quisp guy? I was a Quake guy.
Oh, 100% Quisp right here.
But yeah, I enjoyed Quake. I was very sad they took him off because they said he scared kids. And it's like, I'm not afraid of Quake.
What a happy little Quake. Alien. Yeah. For any uninitiated out there, how I would describe Quisp is take that wonderful sweet flavor of Captain Crunch, not the berries, yep. just the Captain Crunch yep. itself, put it in a smooth flying saucer shape. So it's already yep. better because it's a flying saucer now. And it will not destroy the roof of your mouth like Captain Crunch does. Sorry, like Cap'n Crunch does.
It's the exact same cereal, just pressed into different yeah. molds. Quake was the same cereal, except made in, I think, little O's or Q's, probably Q's. Yeah. But it had more texture yeah. to it. It was a rougher
nuggets.
Texture.
Yeah, more nuggets yeah. than UFOs. And yeah, I yeah. think I may be wrong, but I believe that it was all... It had derived from the same product line earlier, and I don't remember the name of the cereal that it had originally come from, but you know, they weren't selling in that. It's kind of like there used to be General Mills had a cereal called OK's, and that wasn't selling, so they got rid of the K's and just made O's. And then I'm sorry, it wasn't General Mills, it was Kellogg. They had OKs and they weren't selling, so they got rid of the machine that made the K's. They changed the color on the O's and turned it into Fruit Loops. So yeah. that's it devolved. So I think the Quisp and Quake stuff uh-huh. came from some other extruded corn product.
I'm sure that it did. I know Absolutely. that the language evolves and everything, but I love a company setting a bar so Midland to say this cereal is okay.
Okay.
You know, it's the okayest cereal you'll ever have. Hey,
honey, pass me the mediocres. I want to pour a bowl of those.
A solid 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
C plus cereal.
Give me the C plus cereal. Yeah. The C's and little pluses.
There was a period for a while too when I think it was Safeway on the West Coast, one of their sort of house brand cereals, and all these things, you know, at some point come from what the same half dozen factories or something, but they would sell something. I can't think of the name of it, but it was in the giant discount bags, house brand, you know, very feeble attempt at branding. I wish I could think of the name of it because it was sad and bland, but they were basically just, it was absolutely Quisp. It was the same shape and everything. And so amongst the breakfast cereal, Konya Shenti, you could find out that, hey, Safeway's got their, you know, vague O's or whatever they were called in stock. And you could buy those and get your fix for a while. And then those eventually faded away.
Quisp-ish. Yeah.
They probably bought the extruding machines, you know, I bet they bought the equipment.
Well, I was looking.
Our listeners are not going to be able to believe that we don't rehearse these.
No, it's all a well-oiled so machine.
We knew where this was going the whole time.
Oh yeah,
it's all about the cereal.
Yeah, I remember sitting in the theater and saying, "Gosh, this makes me think of breakfast cereal." I don't know why. I love this movie, but now I want some Quisp and some Zonkers before that.
Fighting, you know, alien good versus different, you know, it's Quisp versus Quake. I was just looking up Kellogg's OKs. The original spokes character for this was they were trying to rival Cheerios. So it's like, well, let's add a K to it and it'll be okay. So you know, I could just imagine that meeting. But the first guy that they had was this giant Scotsman in a kilt. Just so you can imagine what the commercials look like, and the name of the character was Big Otis. Yeah, obviously none of the people there had ever watched the Andy Griffith Show, but I think Otis was a flop. So the next year, this was in 1961, and they switched over to having Yogi Bear as the OK mascot. Oh,
that's a winner. Yeah. Man, I wish I'd been in the advertising industry in those days. That would have been something. Okay, guys, I got a Scotsman in a kilt.
Yeah.
It's going to be big. Oh,
I like that, Fees. Go with it. You know, just no matter what you come up with, why not? We'll give it a try.
Free
Nothing's been done before at this point. Funny. Well, so is there any lineage, by the time we got to Special K? Which were just flakes and
just
not
the K's.
K's.
No yeah,
K's
at all. Yeah.
And I just wonder, was there like a K faction inside of the company I mean, other than, of course, being K for Kellogg's, but
just wait for K to come back.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't look, and they didn't look anything like K's at all. And,
no,
and
actually, they didn't.
And just over time, like, they've changed. I don't know if you've eaten Special K lately, but it's yeah, it's not it doesn't look the same.
Nothing does, Jim. Nothing looks the
special,
same.
Nothing does.
Special K came out. There are many sites apparently that are totally devoted to. History of cereal, and apparently it was a 1955 introduction for Special K, wheat, rice, and barley, and then the cereal started. They're trying to sell it in the Caribbean, naming it Kellanova. So apparently, Special K doesn't apply overseas. Apparently, but the important thing with Special K was they had the diet that would go along with it. If you had the Special K challenge, you'd lose weight. If you drank 2/3 of a cup of skim milk and a side of fruit, any fruit you wanted.
Well, that goes way back to the very beginnings of breakfast cereal in the 1880s or 90s. It was built as a health food, and if you ate grape nuts, and you were going to get healthy, by God.
Oh yeah, right. Kellogg was a firm believer in following how your internal movements are working, and checking out what you know. There's I think it's The Road to Wellville. It was
with exactly right.
Hopkins, yeah.
Exactly.
Is it Bridget Fonda in that?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that. And, this whole thing about, you know, it's one thing to buy your cereal from Kellogg's, but to sort of go to Kellogg's compound to go to their farm.
They had a whole farm, Yeah. So listeners, wait for that movie by the minute coming up next.
Yes, exactly.
I did. We're having fun, but I had one more thought on the movie. If we still have any listeners left,
you're all eating breakfast.
And that was, I just love Steve Rogers' nope. When the Red Skull says, "You don't give up, do you?" And Steve just says, "Nope." And Hal, you read that wonderfully. Just nope. You know, it'd be in some other movie, it'd be a spot for the hero to give a speech to make a grand pronouncement about justice and liberty in America, or it would have been a nice spot for Steve to just say, "I can do this all day." He just says, "Nope." And to me, that's a character moment, man. That's a choice the writers made just to say, "That's how Steve Rogers is going to tackle this problem. No time for chat. We're just gonna rush the guy with my shield."
Yeah, and that's what a scrappy kid from Brooklyn would say.
And he's not worried at all about what's going on, which to me, that's Joe tying this to the attitude in The Rocketeer when Lothar, the heavy, the muscle, comes into his house and grabs Cliff Secord and pushes him through the ceiling and said, "Where's the rocket?" And he said, "Are you sure you have the right house?" And it's like, this is so out of context. You know, you were expecting, like you were saying, you're expecting this big clash of giant words, and it's like, nope, not interested in getting into a debate over this.
That's a great comparison.
And it is, again, Steve's really lucky. First, he didn't get decapitated by a girder. Second, Red Skull never shot at his legs. Yeah,
that's exactly. You know, I guess one other thing we can chat about just briefly before we get back to cereal, which is clearly what we all really want to talk about. You know, this idea of these flying bombs, this is another thing where, you know, Joe and the production designers and writers and things have taken something and extrapolated on it. I think the in World War II, the German, terror weapons, the vengeance weapons, the V1 and the V2 are pretty well known. The V1 buzz bomb is what we would look at today and think of as kind of a sort of an aimable cruise missile. But what some people don't know, so it was a ramjet engine, pulse jet. That's the word I'm looking for. Pulse jet engine made a very distinctive sound, and it's just a bomb with wings. And they were on portable launchers. They experimented launching from the water. They did experiment air launching them like this, and it was essentially on a timer, and so they'd launch them toward England, and then after a set amount of time, the pulse jet would cut out, and it would just descend and crash and explode. And so for the for people in Great Britain at the time, when you heard that distinctive buzzing noise, as long as it kept going, you knew you were safe. But as soon as it stopped, you were running for cover. But what some people don't know is that they were experimenting. Germans were experimenting with piloted versions of that. And they were, Brian, you mentioned the term suicide mission before. When the Germans came out with it on paper, they were meant not to be used in a suicide mission, but just to be more precisely aimed. And then the hapless pilot would tear off the tiny canopy and clamber out and bail out at the last minute. Coincidentally, right in front of the intake to this flaming pulse jet engine, which is fine. They did a number of tests with that, and like all the early test pilots were crashing on landing, crashing anyway, until they went to Hannah Reich. I think we've talked about on this program.
Yeah, the movie. What was the movie for that?
Oh, there was,
I'm sorry. I can't remember. Yeah, I do. I do remember. Well, keep talking, and I'll look.
Yeah,
it
so
up.
You can think on it and with your Google brain and see what you come up with. So they brought her in, and then she realized that all these pilots were trying to land these things. They're used to sort of traditional aircraft, and these are small and heavy with stubby little wings, so they have to fly really, really fast to generate lift. So they were just flying too slow and stalling on landing. So she was the only one that I know of that ever successfully, you know, flew one of these things and landed it. But to my knowledge, they never actually deployed them. In fact, it was Hitler himself eventually banned the idea of using them manned. But kind of in parallel with that, and you know, a different culture, a different mindset, the Japanese famously had the Oka flying bomb, which from across the room, very similar configuration to the V1, just short, stubby, straight wings, you know, an engine at the back. And those were, you know, unabashedly meant, of course, as suicide weapons. So there was the Oka, then there was a follow-on that they were developing. I think it was the Boca that didn't go anywhere. But anyway, certainly, so this is one of those things that's not without precedent. You know, one look at Red Skull and you can say, yeah, he's going to order these guys onto suicide missions without batting an eye. Can he bat his eyes with that skull? Does he have?
I guess we've seen him blink.
Yeah, I think he blinks. We've seen him blink. Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm going to make Hal say, oh, that's right. It was Operation Crossbow.
Oh, that's right.
It's like I'm nope. Yeah, nope. One of the great stories about the V1 attacks on London was that at the same time Operation Crossbow was going on, the British had something called Operation Double Cross going on, and they pretty much ran the table of every supposed Nazi agent in England. They were sending back false information through the British, you know, MI6 or MI5. No, it was MI5 that was inside the country. So MI5 was sending back false information to the Germans. And what they would do is when the V1 landed and blew up, the Germans were setting the timers based on their network of spies. And so what they did was they told the spies to tell the Germans that the bombs were landing far west of London. So they dialed down the ones that were hitting central London, and they dialed it down so they were landing in, you know, potato fields in East Anglia. And they would report, oh, a direct hit, you know, he just hit Westminster Abbey and things like that. And that, you know, it wasn't going on like that. So
it's just wonderful. Astounding the complexity of that, and to just to have that presence of mind, you know, when you think about how little they knew about it, at least initially. It's just there's this weird noise and something exploded. You know, what was that? I didn't see any airplanes. And to get from there to then having the intelligence network and the deductions to figure out, okay, these are based on a timer, and how do we mess with that and send bad info upstream? That's fantastic.
Yeah, it also saved a lot of lives when the V2 replaced the V1, because the V2 left, you know, landed with no sound. It just boom, you're gone. There's so many fascinating books and stories about the counterintelligence for Britain that's worth a movie in itself.
Absolutely.
Wow. Well, we've really delved. I guess we talked about this much. We're going everywhere else.
We did, and plus.
We talked about the snack foods content and the cereals in this minute, and
So you know, somewhere if you've got a
touched on vengeance weapons, and
we dug all the way down to the bottom of the box and pulled out the toy surprise.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Right. Just clip that coupon. We appreciate you hanging in through all this. We got some other great things coming up shortly. Hal, I know, is going back on assignment. for our next episode, but he will return in the next minute after that. So, but we would like to thank you for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we are always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. If you do like the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this particular episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. We've got a great guest coming up in our next episode, so check in on there. But be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.